From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Compared to our imaginations, robots have underperformed, but they're coming. Mighty Google has snapped up 8 robotics companies in 6 months. They've got plans, so do others, and not just to vacuum your floor. This hour On Point, where we stand with robots. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen the headlines? Robot love, killer robots. Are you ready for robots? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Robots in factory settings, lots already. They're coming out of their cages. Reading this week, the headline, killer robots there. What if they whack into you? But we'll need them in the workplace, says Rodney Brooks, creator of Baxter. This is a manufacturing robot. Here's a TED Talk given by Brooks last year about why we'll need them. The Americans, people all over the world, aging.
They're older, and they're getting older and older. There aren't many young people coming into factory work. And as their tasks become more onerous on them, we need to give them tools that they can collaborate with, that they can be part of the solution, so that they can continue to work and we can continue to produce in the US. And so our vision is that Mildred, who's the line worker, becomes Mildred, the robot trainer.
Could be your future. Robot trainer. Lots of artificial intelligence beginning to flow in here. Dangers associated with that? Well, maybe. On his show last week tonight, on Sunday, John Oliver interviewed physicist Stephen Hawking. Oliver asked Hawking about his warnings about the dangers of artificial intelligence. Robots came up.
Are you saying that robots are going to destroy humanity? And is that a scientific argument or the pitch for an amazing movie?
Artificial intelligence could be a real danger in the not-too-distant future. It could design improvements to itself, and outsmart us all.
I know you're trying to get people to be cautious there, but why should I not be excited about fighting a robot?
You would lose.
You would lose, says the great Stephen Hawking. Let's dive in. Joining us first today from London, Oliver Morton, editor at The Economist. He edited their recent special report, The Rise of the Robot. Oliver Morton, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
You point back in time and say, look, our imaginations got going in a hurry on robots. As soon as we saw modern technology coming together, we quickly imagined a kind of mechanical version of ourselves. It was a sort of a nightmare many times, and sci-fi people got way out ahead of the actual science and application.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why we still have this very interesting relationship with robots, is that the robot was invented as a piece of fiction well before there was any technological truth on the ground. And into that fiction, we, through writers and filmmakers and other conduits of popular imagination, we poured in all our hopes and fears about technology, that it might be deadly, that it might take away from us, but also that it might enhance us, that it might be cool and sexy. We did all that in advance, and now we're seeing the robots of reality trying to live up to what we imagined they might do. And in some ways, they are a disappointment, because very, very few major works of science fiction have ever been written about vacuum cleaners, and that's what most robots do. But in other ways, they're beginning to become interesting to us, and we're beginning to reassess the question what it would be like to have autonomous or seemingly autonomous machines, not just in labs or not just on production lines, but as part of the social world in which we already interact with each other.
What are the elements that are coming together to make that look more likely, the rise of the robot?
Well, I think there are various things. One is that it just takes time. I mean, we've had industrial robots since the 1970s, and we get more and more of them. You can't make a modern car without robots. If you look at some of the most modern cars, you'll see some of the most modern robots making them. Mm-hmm. We're also seeing robots, coming out into service sectors like the famous floor cleaners. But I think there are two or three real factors that are making a big change right now. One of them is cloud computing. It means that a robot no longer needs to carry in its head all the processing power it needs to solve problems. It can phone a friend, because we now assume that robots will be working mostly in places with Wi-Fi capability. So robots can talk to each other and to other computers to get an idea of what's going on. It's also just much easier to make components for robots now, because we've been making components for mobile phones. And so we have cheap, fast computers, we have sensors of all sorts, not just cameras, that can be used to give robots senses. And a rather interesting one that you wouldn't stand out immediately as obvious is that we can now good enough to simulate what robots do in a computer simulation. And that sounds sort of like second order and strange, but when one of the big jumps in chip making in the 1970s was when people designing computer chips began to be able to test them through simulation rather than having to make the whole chip and then find out what went wrong with it. Something like that is happening now with robotics, whereby you can test out what the robotic program does in a simulator before you actually instantiate it in metal and plastic. That could allow much quicker development.
It's not just theoretical. You smoking a pipe in London, there's a lot of investment going on here. Google invested in 8 robot startups last year. What might they have in mind? What's drawing them in?
Well, funnily enough, I've asked and they're not yet telling you.
Yeah.
One of the things is that there are a lot of smart people in robots, and Google is well known to buy companies sometimes because it wants smart people associated with them. But Google, if you think Google is going to be something like the new General Electric of the information age, it's got to do some manufacturing at some point, and computers and robots might be part of that. It also might be thinking about robot mobility. One of the companies that it bought is a company in near Boston called
Boston Dynamics.
I said General Dynamics,
yes, yes.
But they of course do something
else.
Boston Dynamics make robots that run around at great speed.
We have some video up at our website, by the way, of exactly that. At onpointradio.org, you can see one called Cheetah, really going.
Yeah, no, goes like the clappers, that one. But then again, they also bought a company that uses robots basically to make artworks. And so guessing from what they're doing, what they're going to do with robots is pretty hard. But guessing that they're pretty serious about doing something with robots is a no-brainer.
You say as consumers and citizens, we will benefit greatly. As workers, you're not so sure.
Yeah, I mean, there is a clear question about the degree to which robots take jobs. It's very interesting that in Japan, which is a very robot-friendly society, they love their robots. They had the advantage that when robots came into the Japanese car industry, it was at a time that the Japanese car industry was booming. And so the robot came in very much as a friend to the worker because it allowed you to make even more of the great Japanese cars that were making Japan the great industrial leader that it was. So if you bring in robots don't necessarily eat up jobs. They can allow people to have to do more. I mean, we were hearing from Rod Brooks just before I came on, mm-hmm, about the idea that Baxter can be trained by people with current production jobs to help them do more. And there's definitely that possibility. But there is also the possibility that there are some jobs that robots will absolutely take. For instance, there's robots for moving trolleys around hospitals. I think that, you know, hospital porter jobs, which we should remember are not particularly satisfying jobs and have very high turnover rates, seem to be the sort of thing that robots might be quite good at.
I mean, I've seen numbers as high as 70% of current jobs that could go robotic.
I think that I've seen that estimate too. I think that's a little high, but you should also, and those aren't so much robotic. Those are also jobs that could be replaced by artificial intelligence of other sorts. So don't think necessarily that things that bend metal or that dig, mm-hmm, earth are done by robots and they can be replaced. People who talk on telephones can also be replaced by artificial intelligence programs. People who put together news stories can be replaced by artificial intelligence programs. Yeah.
This line between robots and AI presences seems to be blurring a little bit. I mean, is it not a robot unless it has a physical manifestation? If it's doing something that a person would do but without being there clanking around, is it not a robot?
I think that we kind of have to go with the science fiction writers who brung us, and we have to say that, yes, robots are the clanky movie things. It's certainly true that there are other things that artificial intelligence does, but I think there's a distinction in the popular mind that's worth hanging on to between things that actually operate in the physical world and are driven by their sense of their own position in that world and make decisions based on that. That's different. I mean, we are embodied intellect. I know I'm speaking down a line from 5,000 miles away, but we are, you know, embodied. And because robots will be in our social world as embodied entities, I think that's a distinction that it's important, certainly helps to cling on to for the moment.
You're looking at the horizon and saying that robotic prowess will, to some extent, be taken for granted. We'll live in a world imbued with robotic capacity.
Yeah, there's a lovely thing that Danny Hillis, brilliant computer scientist, said in the 1990s, which is technology is what we call stuff that doesn't work yet. And similarly, robots are what we call stuff that we haven't yet just decided is a trolley or a car or a vacuum cleaner or a camera. Because, you know, the idea that cameras will always be things that you have to hold in your hands may be one that goes away. Cameras may move around and get the point of view that you want. We haven't even talked about the other things drones could be doing.
Behind us right here, the sound of a factory in Slovakia where high-tech robots stamp, shape, and weld for the Kia Sportage SUV. Now we read they're coming out of the cage. People writing about killer robots. We'll look at that. But also, robots with emotion, loving robots. Oliver Morton is with us, editor at The Economist, joining us from London. Oliver, please stand by there. Great to have you with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about robots on the rise, sometimes fast, sometimes slow, but relentlessly, what they can do, what they can't, and what's coming. Oliver Morton is with us from London, editor at The Economist, edited a special report there, headlined The Rise of the Robot. We've long imagined way out ahead of what was possible, but a lot of threads are coming together. AI, artificial intelligence, not the least of them. We got a big workout of thinking around that in the 2013 film Her. Theodore, played by Joaquin Phoenix, falls in love with his smartphone's voice-based operating system, a woman named Samantha, voiced by Scarlett Johansson. Here's a scene where Sam and Theodore, human and disembodied intelligence, meet, quote-unquote, for the first time.
So do you know what I'm thinking right now?
Well, I take it from your tone that you're challenging me. Maybe because you're curious how I work? Do you want to know how I work?
Yeah, actually. How do you work?
Well, basically, I have intuition. In every moment, I'm evolving. Just like you.
Wow. That's really weird.
Is that weird? You think I'm weird?
Kind of.
Why?
Well, you seem like a person, but you're just a voice in a computer.
I can understand how the limited perspective of an unartificial mind would perceive it that way. You'll get used to it. Was that funny?
Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm funny.
There from Her. Yeah, you want to know how Scarlett Johansson or Samantha works? Maybe you do. Do you think that's going to stay disembodied? Maybe not. Here's Pepper. This is a robot created by SoftBank, introduces itself as at its unveiling. This was at a press event near Tokyo, Japan. The robot uses cameras and sensors to recognize human emotions and gears conversations in a direction to make people happy. I don't know if that speaks to you, but it might one day. Where's all this going? Google's getting involved. Here's Wyatt Newman, professor of electrical engineering at Case Western, speculating to CNN on why Google would want to purchase so many robotics companies.
Google is heavily invested in information, in data, which is a step away from knowledge. Right? So if you have embedded data, embedded information, embedded knowledge in a machine that can move around and change the world, that's a step well beyond just a display on a screen.
The Rise of the Robot, the headline in Oliver Morton's The Economist. Let's go to the people with hands-on work going on. Howie Choset joins us from Pittsburgh, professor at Carnegie Mellon's Robotic Institute. Howie Choset, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello, Tom.
And from San Francisco, we're joined by Ken Goldberg, roboticist, professor of industrial engineering and operations research in robotics, automation, and new media at the University of California, Berkeley. Ken Goldberg, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
Author of The Robot in the Garden. Ken, first to you, what looks most promising out there on the robotics front? We had a big conference at MIT a couple of weeks ago where we heard frustration, you know, promise, but also frustration. Where's the frustration? Where's the promise? What do you see coming?
Well, the big issue with robotics is uncertainty. if you put yourself in the position of a robot, the world is very uncertain. You don't know exactly where things are. You don't know where your own end effectors are. So there's a lot of challenges for how do you resolve that. Humans do it very well.
Could you pause there for a second? Uncertainty, meaning within the robot's intelligence, if we can call it, end effectors, I'm not sure what that is. You're saying uncertainty about understanding where it is in space or in relation to other intelligences?
No, well, where it is in space and where other things are in space. Mm-hmm. So just imagine you want to have a robot clear the dinner table.
Okay.
This is the dinner table for us is fairly easy to perceive. But for a robot, everything is blurry, jarred, jagged. It's very difficult to negotiate and navigate.
May I ask you why that's the case? I mean, we already see satellites looking down from space and seeing things hundreds, thousands of miles away with great detail. Why would a robot be, you know, its vision be blurry or messed up?
That's a great question, because there is a discrepancy between the registration, between where a robot is in space and what it's seeing. So when it wants to reach out and, for example, just pick up a glass, mm-hmm. there's lots of imprecision in getting the hand to where the glass is and making contact. We do that all the time, but it's very hard for robots.
We have video up on our website, On Point Radio, that's been viewed millions of times on YouTube of a robot folding towels at UC Berkeley. That seems like a kind of successful engagement that would also be welcome in many households.
Absolutely. And that's a great example of work by my colleague Peter Abiel. And the idea there is that required an enormous amount of programming effort and statistical modeling of the environment, which is the new breakthrough, which, as Oliver mentioned earlier, the big advantage of the cloud, and I believe why Google is getting interested in this topic, is that the cloud offers the capability of being able to do vast computation that was not feasible even 5 years ago.
And not to have all that on site inside the body of a robot. How we chose it, if robots are having trouble just determining where they are in space and how to physically interact with objects around them, that would seem to be a pretty giant hurdle. I mean, that's the whole point, is interaction.
Yeah, that's something that we as people or as animals really take for granted. We're so good at reaching for that glass, grabbing it just with the right amount of force until we can feel we have it right, and then manipulate it around. Something for us seems so easy, a lot of people may be disappointed that robotics hasn't gone that far because what they can do is so easy must naturally transfer over to something that can be done very easily. And that's the disconnect. That's why there's been a lot of disappointment.
Let me go to our callers. They've got questions for all of you already. Savannah, Georgia, Brad is calling. Brad, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I'm a med student, and I've worked some with the Da Vinci robotic surgical technology, and it's interesting in that it definitely has pros as far as being able to use the robotic arm to be more precise. For example, you can set the precision to 3-to-1 movement, where for every one movement of my hand, or for every three, it'll move the robot arm one. So it can be more precise. You can rotate the arm 360 degrees, which is something you can't do with your hand.
Mm-hmm.
But it also creates an unnatural feeling for something like tying a suture, because it's easy to tie with our fingers, but it's not as easy to use the robot for something like that. Or you know, if anything goes wrong, it's a little more unnatural.
Now that's very interesting. Brad, stick with us. Ken Goldberg, there's not less but more precision in interaction, but this is human-guided robotic arm. What about that kind of combination of human and robot capacity, if that's the way you look at it, Ken?
Well, that's very interesting, and the Da Vinci is a perfect example of this, where currently the Da Vinci is completely operated by the human. And as your caller said, there's one big problem is there's no haptic feedback. You don't have that sense of touch. But one thing that we're working on right now, which we're very excited about, is the potential that the robot could start to do some subtasks autonomously, like, for example, performing a suture under the supervision of the surgeon. But this would open the door to not having the surgeon have to do everything directly.
Brad, can you see the robot taking your place one day? Can you imagine that?
I can imagine it, sure, but how would they respond when something goes wrong, when you nick an artery or the common bile duct, would they be able to, whereas, you know, they could be set to tie a suture over and over again, but if anything goes wrong, if the patient moves, if something changes, will they be able to respond the same way that a surgeon could with his hands?
It's a great question. Howie Chosit, what about this meeting of artificial intelligence and mechanical capacity when you look at the array of possibilities in the physical world where anything can happen? Nick an artery. You don't plan to do that, but it happens. Is AI growing at the pace that could, you can imagine, imagine's a big word, but you could foresee robots being able to respond to sort of infinite potentialities in any physical setting?
So we should view the robot, let's say in the medical case, as a more advanced tool. You know, just like with a laparoscope, you know, a minimally invasive surgical tool, you still run the risk of nicking an artery. However, when that happens, you revert to an open case. You sort of go through the same fail-safes that you would have with the robot, with the laparoscopic tool. However, with the robot, you have some additional benefits. Because there is this artificial intelligence running in the background, you have other safety programs that could alert the physician that something may be about to happen, which you don't get from a conventional surgical tool, to perhaps avoid these kinds of problems. But there's always going to be a worst-case scenario that we have to plan for, and that's where the people really come in.
Let me get another call right here from Oklahoma City. Drew is calling. Drew, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. My question is about that intersection between the artificial intelligence and the mechanical human. You talked about the robotic surgeon, and eventually we'll probably see robotic firefighters and policemen were taking the role at dangerous jobs. But eventually, I think it's going to come down to the mundane, where we're going to have mechanical human beings that where we're able to replicate the mechanics of a human, but not the artificial intelligence. And so therefore, I think you're going to end up with sort of a robotic butler, not with an artificial intelligence, but controlled via telepresence from someone in a third world country. And I wanted to see what the ramifications of that were.
Whoa, that's interesting. You mean somebody kind of lashed all day into, as the intelligence remotely, into the machine sitting in your house? Oh my gosh, Ken, are we going to have people sitting in Bangladesh clearing our table by acting it out, you know, executed by a butler in Delaware?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, that's sort of outsourcing meets robo-sourcing,
yeah.
the combination
Wild.
Of the two. Yeah, it could be. I mean, you could imagine, I think this idea that there could be human call centers available for when robots get stuck. So the analogy just today, you know, you pick up the phone and you reach a robot at a call center. Imagine reversing that, where a robot is out trying to do something in your house, like declutter, and it gets stuck in a corner and it calls a human at a call center to help it diagnose and figure out what's wrong.
Oliver Morton, my mind is getting a little blown here. That sounds like a kind of remote slavery, sitting around waiting for the robot to need you to clean the dishes in Kentucky.
I think it is. There's definitely a worrying aspect to that. But I think you also have to remember that we talk about robots replacing people, but in fact, most of what we do, we don't do as pure individuals. We do almost everything we do as part of teams, and already some of the members of the teams are far flung. I think that if you can build a certain level of respect into processes, you can have these processes whereby, you know, you have many different people and tools of various different levels of autonomy cooperating on a task. And I think that I quite agree that virtual presence is going to be an interesting part of how this develops. And was one of the things that impressed me most when I was researching the special report was how easy it is to be on another continent if you have a virtual presence system that allows you to wander around talking to people.
Wow. Autonomy, integration, both potentially at work here with robots. Howie Chosit, speak to rollout of capacity. If you look forward, knowing what we're able to do today, technologies coming down the line and coming together, what kind of applications do you see coming in what sort of sequence here? Are callers thinking about robots that would go into situations of danger, a firefighter or a policeman? There are obviously industrial applications that are already quite widespread. As you look, and we've got vacuum cleaners running around on carpets, look forward, sort of, I don't know, five-year by five-year chunk or decade by decade. What do you see coming at us in terms of robotic capacity application?
Well, the role for robots in service industries, in the factory, in medicine, you know, that's going to continue to evolve. We're going to see more sophisticated tools that people can use or even cooperate with, you know, to carry out their day-to-day tasks as well as their jobs. You know, using medicine as an example, again, I see further evolution of robots, maybe not like the anthropomorphic Da Vinci robot that we have now, but something that looks like an endoscope evolved into something more intelligent, you know, something snake-like, if you will,
mm-hmm.
That a person would, you know, sort of like in the movie Total Recall, when they stuck something into that person's nose to get that little probe out of his face.
Yes.
I think we'll see more capable mechanisms that would steer themselves, but at the high-level control of the surgeon. We'll see that in search and rescue. We're going to see robots serving as tools to extend the reach of rescue workers so they can do their jobs safely and more effectively. In the factory, I think we're going to see a lot more of robots cooperating with people, as you say, getting out of the cages, to have people and robots to both play to their strengths.
Snake robots, that's your area of expertise, right? Mainly for medical or for rescue? Or are you working on all kinds of applications that they would snake in, not anthropomorphic, not human style, but snake style?
Yeah, we're looking at applications for minimally invasive surgery. We're also looking at applications for search and rescue, as well as inspection and repair inside of nuclear power plants. The idea is a lot of times there are unforeseen problems that we don't know about until a pipe bursts. But if we can have a robot crawling around a network of pipes constantly checking for small problems before they become big, we can then alert the proper management to go carry out whatever changes you need to make.
Ken Goldberg, what percentage of robots do you imagine looking something like humans, anthropomorphic, and what percentage do you think will be of, you know, infinite other designs, something we might not recognize as a sci-fi robot at all?
Well, it's. I think a lot of that's going to be driven by cost, and anthropomorphic robots are very expensive. And I think although you've seen something like Pepper come out, it's going to have very interesting – I'm going to be interested to see what happens with that. But there are things like, for example, Nest, which is the advance in home automation. It just looks like a box on the side of your wall at home, but it has robotic capabilities because it can control the environment. So those are examples. I also think there's something that we haven't talked about yet, which has to do with robots being used for education.
We'll look at that and more. We'll look at the legal side here. When robots start doing a lot more things with more autonomy, where's responsibility lie? Oliver Morton, I've just got you half for a minute. Net, do you welcome this coming trend, this wave, Oliver, or fear it?
Net, I welcome it because I like the expansion and the way it offers us for seeing the world. You see the world as both the social world and the physical world in a richer way when you do this. And so though there are doubtless some dangerous potentials, I think that having this sort of autonomous capability among us could make us better people.
Oliver Morton, you write about this very wonderfully for The Economist. The big piece was called The Rise of the Robot. We appreciate your being with us today, Oliver. Thanks so much for joining us from London.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about robots on the rise, what they can do, what they can't, and what is coming. Howie Choset is with us from Carnegie Mellon's Robotic Institute. Ken Goldberg is with us from San Francisco, author of The Robot in the Garden, professor of industrial engineering and operations research in robotics, automation, and new media at the University of California, Berkeley. You may be working next to a robot. Baxter is a robot headed into workplaces, factories, created by Rethink Robotics, according to Mike Bugda, their product manager. Baxter's unique, he says, in that it can be trained manually by line workers without any program and can work safely, big issue, around people.
The idea of the robot is that it's very easy to use, very compliant to the user, and it exhibits a certain level of interaction, collaborative friendliness that makes it easy to understand and introduce into a manufacturing environment.
There's the dream in a manufacturing environment. Could go outside there as well. Of course, imaginations always work on this. The 2012 film Robot and Frank, one robot voiced by Peter Sarsgaard, sent to live as a caregiver for the elderly Frank Langella. The robot cooks and cleans, also encourages Frank to keep up activities like gardening and hiking to keep him healthy. It's robot's number one mission.
I hate hikes. You see one tree, you see them all.
While my program's goal is to improve your health, I'm able to adapt my methods. Would you prefer another form of moderate exercise?
I would rather die eating cheeseburgers than live off steamed cauliflower.
What about me, Frank?
What do you mean, what about you?
If you die eating cheeseburgers, what do you think happens to me? I'll have failed. They'll send me back to the warehouse and wipe my memory.
Well, we're going to walk. We might as well make it worthwhile.
There you go. The robot taking care of the aging human. Ken Goldberg, Howie Chosett, what about the aging demographic in this country and others? Do you see robots playing an important role coming in behind weakening humans or of that age, or humans that need particular help at that age, Ken?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm getting to that point myself, and I can appreciate the idea that the robot mentions memory there. I mean, as we start losing our memories, I think that's where robots could come in, play an important role, where they'll be there to prompt us, suggest things. I mean, I can foresee a very important role for that.
And Howie, what about, we've got lots of feedback online here, people worried about jobs. I mean, Matt says, if you can't compete with an autonomous robot that can work 24 hours a day without a break or sleep, then you're lazy and deserve to lose your job. Go capitalism! Exclamation mark. And here's another, says, with all the discussion of income inequality, robots have been carving out not the lowest paying jobs, but many of the ones of the middle class. What about that usurpation of jobs done by humans, Howie?
So we're actually seeing robots help create jobs. Robots are, again, tools that augment the capabilities of people. The more capable, the more efficient we are as people, the better, cheaper, easier it is we'll have building products.
Sounds good, but there's a lot of skepticism as I look over these comments online. Bill in Russellville, Kentucky. Bill, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, sir. Used to work at the U.S. Army as an EOD technician. He had a vehicle we called a robot. When it malfunctioned, it made a bad situation worse. My question for you is this. What about medical technology, specifically nanotechnology? What happens when you get a programming error there? What safeguards are in place?
Safeguards and liability. What, Bill, in the military, this robot was working in on the bomb squad? Did I get that right?
Yes.
Where you don't want to have a mistake, but what happens if it does happen? Bill, stand by. Let me bring in another guest to go at that. Mark Aaron Goldfeder is with us from Atlanta, senior lecturer at Emory University School of Law. He's been writing about the age of robots and the law. Mark Aaron Goldfeder, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
There's a former military man who's worked alongside the robot in bomb squad work. Robots are in all kinds of situations where a mistake could be costly, could be deadly. He mentions medical, but, you know, we're reading in the New York Times this week about killer robots in industrial situations. They're coming out of their cages where they traditionally work to keep people safe around them. They're becoming more autonomous. You're arguing that at some point, well, I mean, you raise the question at least, at what point does a computer move from property to personhood in legal terms?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is necessary as we move deeper into robot sophistication?
Well, I mean, honestly, I think you have to take a bit of a step back for a second to traditional contract law before you can get to tort liability and even killer robots. Under traditional contract law, you know, you have two parties that agree to the terms of a contract, and that's how things work. Now, already on the internet, you see when you buy from eBay or Amazon, and I would take issue a little bit with the distinction between mechanical robots versus the bots that we use every day, but what you're seeing is more autonomous bots that are making new terms, and really, you know, neither party in a contract anymore is aware of the actual terms.
Let's just clarify that. When you say bots, you mean a non-robot work without a body, without a mechanical aspect.
Exactly.
Just a computer bot, software bot.
A semi-intelligent, autonomous, semi-autonomous program that's making decisions for you. And we've stretched the legal doctrine a little bit in the past 10 years to say that, well, you know, if the terms are reasonable and conspicuous and a reasonable person could have known that works. But as we're seeing it, robots and bots get more and more intelligent, it makes less sense. That's similar to what you were talking about earlier in regard to robots being tools, but then getting more and more intelligent. And so from some point, from a legal perspective, it makes much less sense to pretend that the robot is actually a tool and to give what we might call agency, which is the ability to bind their third-party owners. And this is where people get very confused, because I'm not saying it doesn't make sense that robots should be treated like humans, but it does make some sort of legal sense for robots to be treated as legal persons. Again, legal personality has nothing to do with humanity or morality or sentience or empathy. It just means the capability of having legal rights and duties, including the very, very American right to sue or be sued.
So
corporations are legal persons, states, agencies, other associations.
You wrote, robotic legal personhood in the near future makes sense. But what does that mean? Sue a robot and it doesn't have much of a bank account, presumably.
Well, as a legal person, a robot could, in fact, carry insurance that was purchased by its employer or its owner. You know, as an autonomous actor, it could indemnify others from paying for its mistakes. It could maybe there'd be a predetermined insurance capped amount, which gives the system a sense of fairness and ensures that, you know, commerce can proceed unchecked, because otherwise you're going to have manufacturers that are afraid of producing new robotics out of fear that there's going to be some kind of strict liability. I mean, jumping forward now to home robots, you know, recently we've seen a diffusion of robots into broader society off the factory floor, now in people's homes, in shops and stores and hospitals, nursing homes, and even in your house, starting with the Roomba and moving forward. And if you don't work out the kinks legally, people are going to be afraid to own robots in case things go wrong and there's no one to sue. And manufacturers, on the flip side, will be afraid to develop things, because what if they're sued under a strict liability theory? You know, in tort law, negligence is about the process, who made the mistake, but strict liability is about who made the product.
But liability, I mean, in the fullness of law, goes to more than potential financial claims. I mean, this piece in the Times talking about killer robots, saying 33 workplace deaths and injuries in the U.S. over 30 years. I mean, that's bad, but there's not so many for 30 years. But the robots in the workplaces have been largely caged. They're coming out as they're more autonomous. If a robot's activity, to our caller's question, they're looking at bomb squad action where this could result in death, you know, with people, their personhood and their actual life means they can be charged with manslaughter. They could potentially go to prison. There's no threat in imprisoning a robot, right?
Well, in theory, again, this is a more complicated question. In theory, there are ways to quote unquote punish the robot. If you look at, you know, doctrines of punishment, what things to do with it for deterrence, you could definitely unplug the robot. That will certainly be a deterrent in the future.
To the owner, not the robot. It's just a waste of capital.
Well, again, I mean, if you're looking at the robot as a quote-unquote semi-autonomous thing, you can certainly punish it by taking away its right to exist. But in terms of the issue you're raising about death in the military, but even more so, I would think people should be worried about deaths in robotic cars. It's the same principle. You know, when the robotic car messes up and somebody dies, who's at fault? What's at stake and who's liable? And these are really hard questions, because sometimes accidents are simply unavoidable. You know, suppose that you have two drunk drivers that are both speeding towards the robotic car. The car has done nothing wrong, but now it has to make a choice, which one does it swerve to hit? And researchers have been dealing with these questions. Noah Goodall at the Virginia Center for Transportation Innovation and Research dealt with this question in particular. Suppose you have two motorcyclists, and there's no way to avoid hitting one of them, and one's wearing a helmet and one is not. So the mathematical equation the robot might go through is, well, let me hit the one with the motorcycle helmet because he's more likely to survive. What you've done now is you've penalized the person for wearing a helmet, which also doesn't seem right. So there's all these ethical questions about who has to make that decision. And again, getting back to liability, in theory, we could easily present any and all legal liability for traffic accidents. We could say that people can't drive, and then there'll be no accidents. Or we could say that people could drive, but there's no liability. But we take a middle ground approach. We say everyone can drive, but everyone has to assume a reasonable level of responsibility and take reasonable risks and assumptions. Now, a jury knows, because we're all human beings, that sometimes under pressure, human beings make bad decisions. And a jury might say, well, you did the best you could, whereas they're not going to be as forgiving with a robot. A robot's programmed, and programmers have the ability, designers have the ability and the luxury to think through these problems in advance, and so they need to get it right. You know, a jury won't forgive in the same way when it kills a person. And so even if there'll be less amount of accidents, you might have different people being killed, and that's a really hard ethical question to deal with from a liability perspective.
Mark Aaron Goldfeder, standby. Ken Goldberg, you're listening there in San Francisco. As you're working on robots, design, and applications, are you thinking now about first agency, and well, that's autonomy, I guess, and right along with that, ethics. Are you having to program ethics into the software? Figure out who to hit if you have to hit somebody.
Well, I think that's a beautiful example of the motorcyclist. I think I am thinking about the idea of how robots are being perceived. And I think this goes way back to the way we think about humanity and machines in general. There's this concept of the uncanny that Freud talks about, that we have a very complex relationship psychologically and emotionally with beings where we're not sure if they're real or not, or what their status is. It relates to vampires and zombies and werewolves and all kinds of things.
So, yes, we have a complicated relationship, but once they're out in the world, you can hear Mark Aaron Goldfeder laying the groundwork for a real legal framework around robots. Do you welcome that? Does it scare you?
No, I think it's going to be important. We have to be able to think about these, anticipate them before they catch up with us. I mean, I think we're absolutely going to have to be trying to anticipate and think about them. Yes, it scares me.
Zombies, werewolves, and robots. John in Roxbury, Massachusetts. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
You know, one of the things that's always come up for me as a question is the difference in how robots are perceived in Western culture and, let's say, the Japanese culture. I see that, you know, in Western culture, we still have that original model from that Czech author. I think his name was Karel Kopek, who actually coined the term robot. And his vision was a dark one. They're not to be trusted.
They're kind of Frankenstein vision.
Yeah, and we kind of maintain that to this day, as opposed to the Japanese, who, when I look at what news is being made in robotics, they're the ones who are pushing for a human-like android. They're the ones who are pushing to have them integrated into their society. They're the ones who are really trying to get this real, live, almost artificial human being going. And they don't have the same mistrust, because I think that their culture basically is coming from animism, number one. And number two, they based it on a completely different myth. Their beloved character Astro Boy was basically the whole story. Is nothing but an updated version of Pinocchio, where a scientist loses his own son and makes a robotic son to replace him.
Yeah.
And so their whole mythology is coming from a completely different place.
John, that's terrific. Our time is short, but let me raise it. That is really fascinating. Ken Goldberg here, you've got an animist culture in Japan traditionally, and I wonder if you've witnessed different cultural attitudes toward the whole idea of the robot that might take different cultures down different paths in their development and application, Ken.
That's a brilliant insight, and he's absolutely right. The Eastern culture does come from a very different perspective on robots, and they see them as something that's friendly, not something that's going to encroach and basically compete with us. I think this is, we're also seeing a change in the attitudes from young and old. I mean, generationally, I think kids today are seeing robots as something that they want to embrace, that's something very fun and they can learn from.
Howie Choset, what's your answer to the question about net impact of robots? Will it be a better, happier world as robots emerge and engage? Or are we going to be sidelined and wondering what to do ourselves? Is Stephen Hawking right that we'll end up in conflict with these evolving artificial intelligences and we'll lose?
Yeah, I don't believe that gloom future really is ever going to happen. I just, again, see robots as tools that we're going to continue to develop and use as we've done other technologies, which in the net gain will make us better off. I also want to make a quick comment about the Western view of robots versus Eastern. Obviously, Ken and I, as well as our colleagues Seth and Daniela, who we talk a lot about this, we're always talking about robots, and it's really rare, in all sorts of audiences, and it's very rare to have someone come up to us and express a fear of the robots. We find that most people are just fascinated by what we do. And often when I give talks, I actually ask people in the audience, do you like a robot? And most people raise their hands, but I can actually get half the people in every talk I give to say they love robots. And this is in Western society. So I think there's a lot more love, platonic love, of course, for robots out there in our society as well.
Mark Aaron Goldfeder, just a minute here. You raised the question, at what point does a computer, a robot, move from property to personhood? What's your guess? Put a year on it, Mark. 2016, 2096? When do robots move into legal personhood status?
I think it's a process. I think it begins, again, with agency, the ability for a robot to bind a person, even though it's not a person. And then it moves into sort of a tort situation where it has the ability to sue and be sued, to get some rights under the law. And then, you know, between 30 and 50 years from now, it's a person. But again, personhood here in the sense that a corporation is a person, that it can sue and be sued, it can make decisions, but not that we're going to be, I think robotic marriage may happen, but probably not for another 20 years after that.
Oh, boy. Okay. Our mind is bent just about as far as it's going to go for today at that point. Mark Aaron Goldfeder at Emory University, thank you very much for joining us today, Mark.
Thank you.
Howie Chosett at Carnegie Mellon's Robotic Institute. So great to have you with us from Pittsburgh. Thanks for joining us, Howie.
Thank you.
And Ken Goldberg at UC Berkeley, working in robotics. They're author of The Robot in the Garden. Ken Goldberg, good luck with your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by a whole lot of non-robots. Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gell-Rosen, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Dean Russell. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.